Well, good morning, Reverend Shermie.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. So everyone out there. So right now on our podcast before this show of, you know, why does sexual abuse or abuse in general persist in religious institutions? You know, I've got a little bit of time here before the rabbi shows up to check in with our guest for today, which she is in the midst of writing a book. That's called
Everything in the Church Ain't Holy.
Ain't Holy. So we brought the Reverend Dr. Shermie on today because she is an expert in abuse and sexual abuse in the church, because that's what your doctorate was all about, right?
Yeah, that is true. I don't know if I'm an expert, but it's something that I've been involved with, and being, you know, with the Me Too movement, I've been saying Me Too for over 20 years.
Yeah. All right. Mm-hmm. So today's show that you all are going to be hearing is about a bit of the work that she's done, and then also your take from your research on why this still persists today, even knowing that there's been multiple denominations. This is not just the Roman Catholic Church, but this goes throughout the Protestant Church, and as the rabbi will talk about in the Jewish tradition, and I'm sure in other religious traditions as well. But we want to talk about the why.
Yes.
You know, like, why does this still persist when we have these spiritual homes, these sanctuaries that are supposed to be places of comfort, of healing, of protection, of love, of transformation in a healthy way? But yet we still make these decisions and choices to sometimes protect, cover up, or just ignore abuse that's there.
Yes. I remember being at a conference, Black Women Rise, last year, and one of the women in the audience just said, young girl, she said, well, why don't we just stop? Why don't they just stop? And everybody in the room just kind of looked at her and said, wow, that is a good question. Why don't we just stop? But we don't.
Right. And so we're gonna get into today's show about why don't we just stop, because there are high stakes reasons for the various why different church governance, synagogue governance might not speak about it, because there are ramifications. Because once this word comes out, as you know, that it is it sets a bomb off in the community.
Yes.
And people get very scared and feared of that. And then we're also going to look to be talking about this through also the African-American lens in particular, about what is it like, and maybe from a communal standpoint, of the possibility of taking someone who has been lifted up, who has a good amount of power, who has good standing in the community, and then now the possibility of that person, a Black male, where maybe in the secular society has to jump through all these hoops just to make it, depending on which community they live in, but then now have to deal with his own people taking him down, and then there's some conflict there.
Yes, definitely.
Right.
Definitely that. Strong conflict there.
Yeah. So, and then we'll also get into, you know, what's it been like for you of trying to get this word out, and how the response has been from across the board, and how people respond to you, whether they do it publicly or privately, about this situation. So, so that all that is coming up. We'll have the rabbi here, and we're just happy for you all to be here. Please subscribe to the podcast, whichever you're listening to, whether it's on Stitcher or iTunes or Apple Podcasts. We're across the board. We're all over the place, Podbean, and give a like and leave a comment so we know what you think about the show and what you'd like for us to talk about in the future. And in the comment section, you'll see, hear about Reverend Shermie's book and that she is working on right now, and how to contact her. And of course, if you have been affected in any way by abuse, whether it is domestic or within the church, can you tell them real quickly where they can go?
Yes, if you've been affected by sexual violence in the Treasure Coast area, you can go to the Inner Truth Project. It's in Port St. Lucie, Inner Truth Project, and it provides services for victims of all types of sexual violence, men, women, and teenagers.
And if they're outside of the Treasure Coast, and let's say they're calling they're listening to this podcast from another state, can they reach out to you?
Yes, you can always reach out to me. You can email me at charmaine@charmainedavis.com. That is charmaine@charmainedavis.com. And I'm also on Facebook as Charmaine Davis.
All right. This is going to be a powerful show, but a pertinent show. The rabbi will be here for a minute. We'll just a minute, and we're going to check in with him before we blast off and go onto the radio waves. But God bless you all, and thank you for tuning in to A Priest and a Rabbi.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the program hosts and their guests and are not necessarily those of WSTU, St. Mary's Episcopal Church, and Temple Beit Haim. Products that may be mentioned are not necessarily intended as an endorsement. Any reproduction or retransmission of this broadcast is strictly prohibited. And now, WSTU presents A Priest and a Rabbi. Call in with questions and comments at 220-9788. 220-WSTU. Now, here's your host.
Hey, good morning, Stuart, and all surrounding areas that are picking up this radio show. Almost said podcast. And for all those who are all around Martin County, and for all those tuning in, and actually through TuneIn, because you can actually stream this online, you can stream it from the WSTU website as well. That is at WSTU1450.com. But this is A Priest and a Rabbi. This is a Father Christian, and far to my right is the most handsome man that Martin County. He's not an eligible bachelor, though, ladies. He is taken, and he has two children.
Three.
No, three children. Should we go
four? You've met my children.
Should
we
go four?
You've met all my kids.
All right, Rabbi. So good morning, brother. How are you?
I'm super. How are you?
I'm well. So, listen, you've had an exciting week right now within the Jewish tradition. And something that when you were explaining it to me, and forgive me, it does sound a little bit like a Jewish Halloween.
So we just celebrated Purim, which is, from a non-Jewish context, it's the non-Jewish Halloween. But the story itself is, for us as Jews, it's an important one. Because I think it goes back to, as we've talked in the past about religious persecution, or we talked about, the ability for others to stop or to hamper our religious ideology, our religious faith. And Purim itself is the celebration based on the biblical story of the Book of Esther, which recounts the story of Queen Esther, who saved the Jewish people from annihilation based on the evil decree of Haman, the wicked Haman. And, of course, she was married to King Ahasuerus, the king of Persia. But the story itself, it's a fascinating story. She stands up for her people. She comes forward and tries to remove the evil decree that Haman put forward to destroy the Jewish people. And we celebrate the story every single year. But I remember when I was in rabbinical school, and it's an amazing understanding, is that, the question that what we call the Mishnah, which is the oral tradition of Jewish law, says that we are to read the Megillah at certain times throughout the year, on the 11th, the 12th, the 13th, the 14th of the month, the Hebrew month of Adar. But it says on the 15th, you read within a walled city. So what does that really mean?
Uh-huh.
At that time in ancient tradition, we only really had just a few cities that were walled. One being Jericho, of course, the most famous being Jerusalem, and of course Shushan itself in Persia. And this practice, which has been done for over 2,000 years, is still practiced today. And I remember saying to a friend of mine, and when I was in rabbinical school, contacting my college and saying, this is amazing. We study it in the Mishnah. We read about it, that you read in a walled city. And I remember when we were living in Israel, my wife and I we were living in Jerusalem and went off to Tel Aviv. And, we were dressed in outfits and, revelry and everything else. And we went to a thriving Reform synagogue in Tel Aviv. And there must have been, hundreds and hundreds of people flocked to this community. And everyone was dressed up, and we heard the Megillah reading. So the Megillah itself, just the scroll of Esther, the story of Esther. So we heard the Megillah being read. And everyone, parties and has a great time. And it is very symbolic. symbolic and just an amazing opportunity. But if you were in Jerusalem, you would not hear the Megillah being read on that day or that evening. So the next day, we went back to Jerusalem and miraculously heard the Megillah being read in Jerusalem, inside of a walled city, which just, you know, it put that culture and that just that history back into the forefront of this was been practiced and has been practiced for over 2,000 years.
So let me ask you a question. So now if you want to fully practice it, do you have to like go to one of the 85 gated communities in Stewart or Jupiter and ask for permission to go read it in there?
That's a great visual. No. But
just ask one of your parishioners, can you just get me the gate code? Can you just get me the gate code and get me inside? And, you know, we'll walk around and do this.
We could try.
And no one's going to know as we walk around and do our procession.
So, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, it's been a busy week. You know, the traditional understanding is that you must hear the Megillah being read at least twice. So one, the evening of Purim, which for us came in Wednesday night, and the day itself, so being Thursday. So Wednesday night, we read the Megillah as part of our religious school and part of our community event Wednesday evening. Yesterday, my family and I had the opportunity to go to one of our other communities, Chabad, to hear the Megillah being read with the community itself last night. And then today, we have in about an hour, our Early Childhood Learning Center, our ECLC, at the temple will be doing our Purim costume parade around the temple. So we're quite excited for that.
So those costumes, though, are like who all the characters from the Book of Ruth?
So from the Book of Esther, but
sorry, Esther.
It's okay. You know, it's. I remember as a kid, we would dress up in traditional costumes. So what does that really mean? You know, we dress like Mordecai. We dress like King Ahasuerus. We dress up like Queen Esther or Queen Vashti. You know, but we would, you know, use it in that way. Maybe sometimes somebody would come up as Haman. Today, I think people dress in like Disney costumes or princesses.
Oh, okay.
You know, a large part of it is, you know, to just, you know, and part of the actual Purim story, too, is to put on masks, you know, just to kind of, you know, hide ourselves or reveal ourselves. And the interesting thing with the Book of Esther is the Hebrew itself. So Esther in Hebrew is one who is hidden. And if we look at it, you know, the Book of Esther, although, you know, it is a very impactful and just an amazing story for us to remember year after year after year, there is one entity within the story that is never mentioned. And that entity that is never mentioned in the Book of Esther is God. But God is, you know, God's providence is all over our text, just not explicitly mentioned, which is an interesting thing when it comes to scribal art, for example. Right, for a scribe who writes a Torah, which is a very lengthy process, one that takes a lot of time and energy and focus, is that when a scribe learns to write, say, a Torah, the first text that they practice on before they actually write the Torah itself is the scroll of Esther, is the Book of Esther.
So they don't screw up the name God?
Because it does not have the name of God, so that if they make a mistake, it's correctable. Where if you've written God's name and you make a mistake, that what we call that daf, that page itself, which, you know, is out of animal skin and this, that, and the other, would have to be discarded. And discarded not in terms of tossing it in the garbage or recycling it. It would have to be buried.
Let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Name one other book in the Bible that does not have the name of God or God is present in it.
Oh, man, you just like threw me under the bus here.
Our guest is just staring at me. The Song of Songs.
Yes.
Song of Songs. So you just have the love story that happens throughout all of it. But, there's no mention of God in it.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, romantic, and sometimes even erotic way. That's, you know, when they were choosing, when those that sat around the table chose what was going to be the holy canon, that was one that was on the fringes. But
it's interesting because when you look at that, and you look at the Book of Esther, although God not explicitly mentioned, right, God is all over.
Yeah.
All over.
You guess, yeah.
Because it is
sure.
That love story between Israel and God
right.
And the Jewish people. And
yeah. And then people, then from a Christian perspective, we look at it as Jesus' marriage to the church, mm-hmm. to view it. And that's how we look at marriage. The marriage itself and the marriage rite, at least in the Episcopal denomination, would say that this is your marriage is reflective of Jesus Christ's marriage to the church.
Absolutely.
as you are married to one another. So,
just a quick interesting. So we went to this Megillah reading last night, and my wife came home a little bit early, and you know we were getting up, getting into costumes, and this and the other. And my oldest daughter kind of took her sweet proverbial time. And my wife and I were saying, you know, come on, we have to go. We're being late, this, that, and the other. So she finally threw on a costume. She was an astronaut. So she's dressed up as
straight
an astronaut.
Straight out of Esther. Straight out of the book of Esther. I think that's like chapter two is the astronaut,
absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
And it has to be, you know, it was an orange outfit. So, she's dressed in this outfit. And as part of the activity last night, that they had a masquerade ball. Right. And the ones that were dressed in the best costume were given a prize at the end. And as they called the first one to be, you know, number one winner, then the second, then the third. And of course, my daughter did not win. She kind of shook her head and got very, very, very upset. And okay. I said, what's the matter? And she goes, it's all your fault.
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, well, what do you mean? She goes, well, you and Mom made me get dressed real quickly. And you made me throw on this outfit. And if I would have had more time,
yeah,
I would have won.
She probably
said, okay,
would have.
Let's stop being a sore loser and remember what the holiday is about. It's about remembering, but at the same time, it's also about celebrating the fact that we as Jews are still here, and we will not be deterred, and we will not apologize, and we will not live in fear, and we are proud of who we are. To which my daughter then kind of gave me the eye roll and said, "Come get me later. I'm gonna go play somewhere."
Yeah. Seven-year-olds, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you going to do? All right, so today's show, if you saw the post of what we're going to be talking about today, we do have a special guest with us today because we're going to take a little bit of a right-hand turn here because we're going to go a little bit deeper here and talk about a topic that has just unfortunately plagued. Not only we've seen the headlines, which has mainly been about the Catholic Church, but let's let there be no mistake and be blind that this affects all religious institutions. But the plague of sexual abuse that happens, and abuse in general, from whether it's going to be from our Catholic brothers and sisters to the Protestant church, throughout the evangelical tradition, now we'll talk about within the Jewish tradition as well, and I'm sure from other religious standpoints. So we want to dip into that to ask that not go over information you've just been reading and seeing in articles recently and throughout the last 10, 20 years as more and more gets exposed, but to get to the question of why do denominations, why do religions continue to not really deal with this in an effective manner? People of God, why do they continue to hide it, not begin to talk about it, take really bold steps to eradicate it? And there's some real powerful and well thought out reasons why this does happen. And so in just a minute here, I'm going to bring on our guest here. She wrote her doctorate is about this topic. So and from there, we're going to go into some very other topics that relate to that. So without further ado, let me please bring in the Reverend Dr. Charmaine Davis, who is also the associate minister over at St. Paul AME Church in Stuart, Florida. And we are just so happy to have you on the show because, Charmaine, you wrote, this is what your doctoral work was about, correct?
Yes, thank you. I'm so excited to be here this morning. Yes, that is what my work is. That's my God-called work.
Okay, your God-called work. And when you wrote and you worked on this for your doctorate, was it for particularly the AME church, or were you examining just sexual abuse and the reason for it throughout all denominations and religions?
I did research on all religions, all denominations, but my doctoral research was the African Methodist Episcopal Church, as which I am a member.
Okay, so mm-hmm. for all those who don't know, since there are
55,000 different strands of Christianity.
Yes. And the AME Church has just does have a very historic has a great history and a powerful history too. So can you just give us a brief background on the just how the AME Church began to be and who is the AME Church?
Okay, the African Methodist Episcopal Church is the only denomination in the United States to start a denomination because of discrimination on social justice issues and not theological differences. In 1787, members of St. George Methodist Episcopal Church, which was also white and black, African at the time, members, they had had some renovations going on. And the reason they had the renovations going on is they had this preacher that was by the name of Richard Allen. And he was allowed, as a black man who had purchased himself out of slavery, to have that 5 o'clock a.m. service, which was a service that all black members were able to come to. As his preaching improved, more and more white members also started to come, and the church began to grow. And because the church began to grow, they needed to expand. So they did this renovation. And in the renovation process, they built a loft or balcony. On the day of the blessing of the new church and the new renovations, Allen and the other blacks and whites were all around praying on their knees. Some of the elders in the church began, that were white elders in the church, began to pull up the African members and ask them to move so that the white members could come. And one of the things that historically is being said, that Richard Allen said, if you just let me pray, finish this prayer, you will not have to be bothered with us anymore. And they left that day, and they went on to start what is called the Free African Society, which is was like a benevolent program that provided services for free Africans, and they also had religious services. Then in 1794, they started what they founded the Mother, what we call now Mother Bethel AME Church, which is Bethel AME Church, and they bought a piece of property at the corner of 6th and Lombard Street in Philadelphia. And we still have that church.
Oh, my gosh.
We still have that property. That is the oldest piece of continuously owned property by African Americans in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that piece of property was originally a blacksmith shop. And legend tells that Allen stood on the anvil of the blacksmith anvil and preached. And so that's how we started. However, once they started that church, it still was under the auspices of the Methodist Episcopal Church or St. George's Church. So then there were several lawsuits, well, two different lawsuits that ensued to try to break them away from the Methodist Episcopal Church. And in 1815 was the last lawsuit, which they were able to separate themselves from the Methodist Episcopal Church. And then that is when they officially started in 1816. The denomination of African Methodist Episcopal started in Philadelphia.
Gotcha.
And that's where we are today. And we have like 2.5 members, million members across the world. We have 20 districts across the world. We have 20 active bishops, a host of retired bishops. We're in like 5 continents, 39 countries. And we're everywhere. We're here to stay.
Yeah. And then you're right here in Stuart. And then one of the, we celebrate him almost as in a saint-like way in the Episcopal Church as Absalom Jones, who became, an Episcopal priest that came out of that tradition.
Absalom was there that same day. He was one of the men that were also pulled up that day. And in the process of them starting, Absalom was there when he and Richard Allen started Mother Bethel Church, but there was a difference in theology. And I mean, not theology, but in the way you do church. And Absalom wanted what we call high church,
yep,
which is the Episcopal Church.
Right.
And Allen wanted the Holy Spirit and a lot of shouting and a lot of feeling it. And that's how they split. And so Absalom started the African Episcopal or African American African Episcopal Church of St. Thomas, I think it is.
Okay.
Which I believe it may still be in existence.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so,
and he
but
was
he
ordained
is,
then as an Episcopal priest.
He's the very first African American Episcopal priest ever ordained.
Right. And, Richard Allen is our first elected and consecrated bishop in the AME Church.
Right, there you go. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's your tradition. That's where that's the lens that you come through for a lot of the work that you
yes.
do. And when we all went out to lunch yesterday with you, the rabbi, and myself, mm-hmm. You were pretty direct once we got to the reasons of why does this happen? Why to, for sexual abuse? And because we hear about it a lot, it just in the Roman Catholicism. And there's, you know, as I was looking through articles last night as well, is because since the Roman Catholics, it's one whole united church, are so systematized and have all the paperwork that mm-hmm. once you start digging, it's easy to reveal all the paperwork that's showing. I mean, there's such a big paper trail of who hid this, who hid that, what bishop did that, what cardinal did that. But when you look at other denominations, sometimes they don't have that kind of systematized, right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they're smaller churches or smaller organizations. So it's a little bit harder to kind of follow that paper trail to do critical analysis of it. But from your perspective, what are the main reasons why this still is such – this still persists? I just read the other day, there was an article in the Washington Post, not the other day, but I saw an article from 2018 – they said that if you look at the top three insurance companies for Protestant churches, right, that each year 260 cases dealing with child abuse mm-hmm. Within the church. And that's just from the three big insurance companies that look over Protestant churches. There's many other smaller insurance companies. There's other – and then there's churches that obviously don't. There's
and how – what was that number?
260. This is for child abuse. For child sexual abuse in Protestant churches. Now, this is not talking about adults. This is not talking about what happens when the pastor or starts hitting on, you know, women throughout the.
But
throughout,
you do know it's more than that.
Oh, and we see that's just what's being reported.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just coming from what the numbers you get from the top three insurance companies, their report on the cases they had to deal with. Now, there's many other insurance companies and there's many churches that, as we're going to talk about, it just doesn't get reported for various reasons. So, Reverend Doctor.
So, what if I asked either one of you, how was your sex last night? I hear nobody answering, right? Because people really, you know, I mean, even though you see it on television, but really, people don't like to talk about good sex. So, if they don't like to talk about good sex, they definitely don't want to talk about bad sex. Right. And that's what we're talking about today is... You know, it's not even sex. Mm-hmm. You know, it's abuse, it's violence. But money isn't one of the reasons. Shame, mm-hmm. Pride, all of these things are reasons why people don't talk about this.
So let's go back to money. So tell me more about that.
Money, it costs a lot. It costs churches a lot. You're talking about these 250 cases that you're talking about that the insurance company is involved in. We're talking about millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. You know, $4 million, $3 million, $6 million suits. I know within the AME Church, those are big mm-hmm. numbers. And for a small congregation, that could kill a small congregation. And then, not even talking about those big numbers, just regular tithes and offerings. If you know if something is going on in your church, people are not coming to that church. Mm-hmm. If they know that that pastor is a pedophile, if that pastor is a predator, if that pastor is an abuser, or any member in that church, people are not going to come. Mm-hmm. You're just not going to come. And that, bottom line, money. Mm-hmm. Then pride. People are embarrassed. Is it something that I did, did I do something? A lot of times when it comes to predators, they set you up. It's called grooming. Mm-hmm. So then you may, you know, somebody hugs you. They hug a little too long. You're like, well, maybe it's just me. And so then pride. And then just the shame. The shame that goes along with it and how you are made to feel that it was your fault, how you're made to feel that you're trying to destroy some man's ministry, how you're made to feel that you're trying to destroy and tear up your church, all of those things. And then churches are, they have a spirit, they, well, at least we desire a spirit of niceness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if you got violence going on in your church, that is not nice. Mm-hmm.
Well, just the claim that comes out that at a church where there's you either have a youth pastor or a clergy person that's involved in this, to your point, once even just the mention of that, even if it's a claim that's whether true or false, I mean that you takes years for you to get a good and the person whose name got mixed in with it, I mean, could be done, even if he or she is cleared of all
things. If they're cleared. Because a lot of times the victim or the survivor will leave the church. And we're talking about churches where people have maybe they came to church in their mother's womb. They were baptized in that church. They've been a part of that church family. We use the word family, even though we know that families are dysfunctional. And they've been a part of that all this time. And then maybe a new pastor comes in who just came there. But then again, it's all the value of women, too.
All right,
women and children.
We have a very hot topic right here. And the phone number is 772-220-9788, 772-220-9788. If you have a question here for Reverend Dr. Charmaine, or just in general about this topic, we love to get your insights, your comments, your questions about this. We have a wonderful expert here with us.
But I think the important thing to note as well is, as you said earlier, is there is no religious institution or religious organization that is devoid of this challenge.
Sure.
You know, in the Jewish community, we have it as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it is an abuse of power.
Yes,
it is when you know, at least you know, in our understanding, it is always based on when one has that level of authority or that level of influence that takes that influence, the influential power, and exerts it upon the vulnerable. Those that are seeking a more spiritual life and reach out, and just that abuse, whether it be sexual, whether it be, you know, in any form that it takes. You know, in the Jewish community, we have it. We've had it from, for those that remember the case many years ago of the Orthodox institution in, I believe it was Brooklyn, where the rabbi, when it came to the mikveh, the ritual bath, would have videotape women going in for their own spiritual purification, and you know, it's that sense of abuse or you know, clerical, you know, members of the community who take it upon themselves of a vulnerable person and, you know, start sharing intimate details that then lead to more and more and more, and then have that sense of abuse of, well, I'll make you feel better type thing, and just becomes destructive.
Right. And it's so my question is, in your research, Reverend Dr. Charmaine,
or Charmaine.
Or just Charmaine. Is that cool?
That's
Charmaine.
Fine.
Is that, you know, companies have, they realize they have issues with a car and they let the car go out and they say, well, it's better if we just allow the car to cause the destruction that it does, and we'll have to deal with about 15 to 20 lawsuits, and there might be some lives lost, but that's going to be a little bit more affordable. We know about these class action lawsuits that have happened with different car companies, and that's going to be a little bit more cheaper or more affordable than us having to redo the whole car line and recall all these cars back. And so that's happened in the history, or corporations that will mask a major problem that's happening and try to deal with it internally. And so within the church, I guess, and in the synagogue and any religious institution, we still fall into that trap of trying to protect the institution. And we saw this at Penn State and many other colleges, is that at all costs protect the name of the institution.
Yes.
And so there's two things going on here is but it's such an oxymoron, because in the we are called into this incredible transparency and vulnerability and openness and our sin before God, mm-hmm. as Christians before Jesus Christ, and saying we have this major issue, and I mean, who knows how long? But Bill Hybel over you know, in Barrington at a mega church was finally people coming up, and there was smoke, and there was realized there's so much smoke, there must have been fire about people talking about it. And finally, a lot of the church elders said, okay, enough, this guy's got to go. But why do, is it just fear, Charmaine, that religious leaders have, that if we do, we know something's wrong with you know, Reverend so-and-so. We know something's going on here, but we don't want to say it, and we rather deal with it internally, because is it just like we believe God can heal this internally and we take care of this? We're our own religious institution. I was reading somewhere that there's a fear of the secular world, that if we expose this to the secular world, they're going to just annihilate us and take us down, because the secular world is just trying to take down religion. So let's just take this internally. Or is it just more or less like we have our happy church home, and we don't want to destroy these lives or destroy our church institution, or we don't want to destroy the pastor's life? I mean,
it's kind of all of those things.
Okay.
It's just a mix of all of those things. And when it comes to, we just do the thing with the cards. We do the thing with the cards. We just send them out, and we hope that they are not going to do it the next time, you know, that they won't have the next wreck, because we move them from one church to the next church. Mm-hmm. There's a problem in this church. We move them to a new venue where there's a new fertile pasture of all, you know, of all these innocent women and little girls and little boys that are there. And we just keep doing that and hoping that they will stop. You know, we slap them on the hand. But when it comes to, it's all about the institution.
But it's interesting, given institution and given the clerical responsibility. Right. And I think as religious as religious leaders of communities, I think sometimes there are those that abuse their power that don't really go back to that impactful line from I'm gonna throw it out in terms of Isaiah that says, defend the widow, mm-hmm. defend the orphan.
Yes.
Right. Do not oppress anyone else, and seek justice. Do good. And to remember that it is a responsibility, and it is an obligation, and it is a huge commitment that we take as members of religious institutions, to be able to say it's about the human side of it. We don't want to be oppressed. We don't want to take advantage of others. So therefore, don't do it to
all right,
others.
So let's put ourselves on the hot seat here.
Okay.
So you find out, God forbid, that someone on your staff is involved with an issue similar to what we're talking about. Right. So you know that once you deal with this, and because you can just let the person go, right? Mm-hmm. That can happen. And then now the problem is not affecting your congregation. So at least you got the issue away from potential victims in your.
That's for potential victims, but any victims that how did this come up?
Mm-hmm.
So they're victims because you found out somebody's mm-hmm. been violated. And so now you have that person or that family. See, it's never just one person. It involves, because we don't understand how connected we are, how divine we are, and that each one of us, no matter how stupid we act, it affects everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't, when an abuse situation takes place, that particular offending pastor, preacher may think that it's only about them and what they want. But then they have that victim, they have their victim's family, they mm-hmm. have their own family.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They have their wife, their children that are embarrassed, can't go to school because they're being teased because their daddy's a nut or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have all mm-hmm. of that. You have all of that going on.
And it's also the breakdown of, as you said, the breakdown of community.
Yes.
It's the tearing apart of what the institution was there initially for.
Right. Right.
And I know of a situation last year where there was an incident with a pastor and a member of the church, and he was moved from that church. The new pastor was sent and was not told one thing.
Hmm. About why?
She was not told one thing when this person went to the new church.
Right. So
Why would you do that? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. that church has a big, giant, gaping gunshot wound mm-hmm. in it, and you send someone to pastor that church, and they don't know the details.
Right. Because, you know, once it gets revealed, let's say that God forbid we ever had to deal with this, you know, and so it becomes, you have to open up to the community of why so-and-so was let go, and that there's a family that was affected by this. So you are dealing now, I mean, from a pastoral standpoint, the amount of healing that has to happen, and you have to also deal with the risk of just it might tear apart the community, the mm-hmm. people might leave, and all the different reasons, Charmaine, that you said that then follows. It's the loss of the community. It's a loss of money. It's a loss of everything. You just have to be prepared for that. And this is why people get so scared to bring it up or try to deal with it internally, try to deal with it secretly, because they don't. They know that once this happens, you are dealing with an enormous – a bomb's going to go off in your community.
Yeah. But one of the ways that I see to maybe to stop this at the door is training. Training. Just the idea of teaching clergy persons how to handle boundaries and how to operate and minister within safe boundaries.
Right.
And also how to teach lay people to operate in boundaries and to know when they may be crossing or when their boundaries may have been crossed. Because a lot of times things happen and you don't know. And so before you know it, there's trouble. Marie Fortune, who is a founder of Faith Trust Institute in Seattle, and they provide training for domestic violence and also sexual violence in the church. And this is the premier place to get your certifications. And she talks about two different offenders. One is the wanderer, and the other one is the predator. The wanderer can be any of us, that don't understand how to handle boundaries. We may go too far. We may get involved in what we might think is a relationship. And some of the things in the church, we think of these as affairs. These are not affairs. These are violation of power.
Right.
Because no matter what, the clergy person always has the power. Always has the power. When I was a parole officer in Tennessee, I would explain to my parolees, this is what will happen. If you do this, I lock you up. If you do that, I lock you up. You know. And so any type of domestic violence, any kind of assault, immediately, mandatory warrant, right? And I don't care what she does. If she spits on you, you need to get an umbrella because I'm locking you up.
Yeah, boundaries.
You know, and because we need to understand it. And in the church, we don't because, again, we're afraid to let people know let the secular world know that we're not perfect.
Yes.
But the church is a microcosm of the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't, just because you come to church or join the church does not mean that you stop living in the real world.
Right. And we talked about this before, is that the church is even more susceptible than in the corporate world or some other world where if you were talking about yesterday that, let's say, you and I worked at some corporation and you came in and told me that you had to go to the hospital or something. And I would say, I hope everything's okay and just, you know, keep us posted. Then you left and you did your thing. And then maybe you came back and said, you know, hey, yeah, I'm back. And maybe I mentioned, well, I hope everything went well. And you're like, yeah, I did. And then that's the end of it. And we get back to our work day. Now in the church, you come into the office. Let's say I'm the priest and, you know, you're the associate. And then you say, yeah, I'm going in to the hospital. As the church member, we're like, well, hey, I want to know more. Get to the pastoral place. Now there's can we pray over this? Mm-hmm. Now we're maybe holding hands while we're praying. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're both in a susceptible place because there's something going on in my life. There's something going on in your life that makes us vulnerable to temptation or whatever.
Yes.
And so those moments, it's just the reason, getting back to why boundaries are so important, because the church invites and any religious institution invites this vulnerability for us because we want to care for one another and hold one another and pray for one another and have these intimate moments and sharing conversations you would never share with people at work.
Right. And ministry, like I said yesterday, ministry is a boundary pushing. It's everything about it is boundary pushing.
Yes.
I mean, you tell me that you're having surgery tomorrow. You know, the members of St. Paul know. When they look up, Reverend Charmaine is standing in the hospital. You know, you're getting your IV put in and I'm standing there. But your lawyer wouldn't do that. You know, your accountant wouldn't show up. But that's what we do. What's happening? Do you need to pray? All of these things, pushing. But still in that, we still need to know and realize how to work within those boundaries.
Yes. And I know just from, I mean, we just got back from a big training and every year we have to do it, that of sexual misconduct training, or at one point it was called Safeguarding God's Children in the Episcopal Church. And so, like, when Father Todd came in, my rector, when he came in, the first thing he did was that he realized a lot of the doors, some of them didn't have windows, you know, the doors.
Yes.
Every door gets a window
yes.
here. And then if I meet with a child because I need to, and a parent says, hey, can you talk to my my child about this. We're going to a coffee shop where I'll be sitting at this two top over here with your child while you're sitting four seats away.
Yes.
And so everything is very visible. So there's there's definite steps and boundaries need taken. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we want to further about sometimes why do we want to protect that pastor? And I see particularly, you know, there's a reason why sometimes we in the church protect a pastor, and especially from the African American tradition. Mm-hmm. And let's get into that, because you have some great points about that. So again, the number here is 772-220-9788. We'll take a quick break and continue this show. Hey everyone, it's Father Christian, and it is Lent during this time. And if you are someone who does practice Lent during the Christian season, I want to invite you into a variety of things happening at St. Mary's Episcopal Church right here in Stuart. We have a Lenten lunchtime concert series every Wednesday from 12 to 12:30. And then we will be serving a lunch in the Pinger Center from 11:30 to 1. That's just an $8 donation. So that's all the way up to Easter every Wednesday. Then we have a Lenten series with Vic Copan, who's from Palm Beach Atlantic. So we'll be serving a simple soup supper every Wednesday night. And then he'll be leading us on a reflection at 6:30 p.m. He is the head of ministry at Palm Beach Atlantic. And then also on March 19th, we have a night of healing with Janet Helms, who is the founder and director of Orphan Heart Ministries. And she will be doing a wonderful thing of leading us in a group healing, of grief healing, of soul healing. It's very powerful stuff. She leads 30,000 people sometimes doing this in East Africa. So I want to invite you all into what's happening at St. Mary's, especially during this holy time of Lent. God bless you.
You're listening to A Priest and a Rabbi podcast. If you haven't done so yet, make sure to subscribe. And please leave a rating and a review, 5-star rating and a positive review if you can. We certainly appreciate it. That is the best way to make sure that others out there just like you can find this podcast. If you want to get in contact with Father Christian and Rabbi Durbin, you can do so by emailing apriestandarabbi@gmail.com. And the absolute best way to get a hold of the fellas is to call into the radio show. This podcast airs live on the radio every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on WSTU 1450. And you can listen live online at WSTU1450.com. And if you want to join the show, you can call in to 772-220-9788. That's 772-220-WSTU.
Hey, everyone. This is Father Christian here on A Priest and a Rabbi. So happy for you to be here on this podcast with us. And I want to let you know that I have started a YouTube channel called Your Favorite Christian, and you can check it out on YouTube. And every Monday, I drop a new episode, and it's always through the lens of faith, but taking on different topics such as dating, relationships, marriage, pop culture. I've done one recently where I went out to the art show and talked about how do we find a relationship with God through what all the latest artists are doing. Last week was What Do Women Really Want in a Man, and interviewing different people to be a part of that. So please check that out on YouTube. Subscribe, like, share, put on the notification so you get that every Monday. I also want to let you know of this podcast wouldn't be here if it wasn't for a generous donor from St. Mary's Episcopal Church who wishes to remain anonymous. All he asks, though, is that the information gets out that St. Mary's Episcopal Church here in Stuart has a healing center. And so you can call if you're looking for a counselor, someone to be there for you during a challenging time. And you can call the church at 772-287-3244. We also have a group of Stephen ministers who have been trained, over 50 hours of training, to be with you and walk with you during a time of crisis. They are not counselors. They are trained just to be more of the presence of Christ and walk with you during a time of crisis, whether it's a good crisis of having, oh my gosh, my daughter's about to get married, or if there's something a little bit heavier. So give us a call, 772-287-3244, and I thank that anonymous donor who makes this all possible. All right, God bless you, and enjoy the rest of the podcast. All right, welcome back to the show here, A Priest and a Rabbi, where you can also find us on a podcast on all major platforms, especially iTunes. You just look up A Priest and a Rabbi, you'll see us. Please subscribe, give it a like. We appreciate 5 stars and a comment about what you thought about each show. I was just listening to our show last night when I was working out on Stitcher just to hear how do we sound on a podcast. You know? So, but anyhow, let us.
You've got the radio voice. You have the radio voice.
I think you have the radio show, a radio voice too, my brother. So we were continuing the show about why does sexual abuse continue to plague religious institutions? Why do we continue to hide it? Why do we continue not just to be so forthright and just say we got an issue, we got a problem when they do pop up, especially within an organization that's supposed to be dealing with protecting and loving the vulnerable and being the healing power of and representing the healing power of God. And we want to get even more specific here because Charmaine, you, in your research too, since you focused on the AME church, there's particular reasons why, from an African-American perspective, why sometimes these cases or when these situations pop up are not dealt with in the most transparent way.
Yes, when I started this research and started my project, I had initially thought I would just write a curriculum for, you know, training in this area. And then I couldn't understand and couldn't figure out why what I would write would be different than going to the United Methodist Church, to the Presbyterian Church that already had their curriculums already designed. Why would it be different in my context, the Black church? But as I started to do my research and I came to this understanding of the emasculated Black male, and we look at the treatment of Black men in America from slavery all through the civil rights up until now, with the whole Black Lives Matters and the treatment of Black men. And as I looked at that and the fact that Black men were every day, they were the N-word every day. And the only time they got to be anything, they were boy and the N-word every day during the week. But on Sunday, they got to be Reverend, they got to be brother, they got to be mister. And because of that, we as a race, as a culture of people, because Black men have it so bad with the criminal justice system, with just the employment, with just everything coming out of slavery, when we have a Black man that is doing good, it is hard for us to turn them in. It's harder for us to tell. It's hard. It comes even when you look at domestic violence situations. You look at the difference in a white woman calling the police on her domestic situation, a Black woman calling the police on her domestic situation. Her man is probably going to get to jail. My man may get killed in the yard just because of the way Black men are perceived as demons, as animals, as monsters. And that's the way it is. And so the church, again, it's a place that's supposed to be a place of healing and protection. As a culture in the African Methodist Episcopal Church and in the African American community and the Black community, we tend to protect our men.
So this goes beyond the church.
It goes beyond the church.
And yes. So there's examples of this, just you're saying, just even from a domestic domestic abuse perspective as well.
Yes.
That wives or girlfriends might not call the cops because of, well, fear of what might happen if the cops show up. And then if, God forbid, something horrible happens and you get shot in the front yard, then I have to live with that. That's on me. I made the phone call.
Not only do you have to live with it, your whole community makes you have to live with it. If something comes up in the church, very many times, women are told, you know, just leave it alone. Don't mess up that pastor's career. You know, can't you just leave it alone? Don't do it. You know, and they will force that woman out of the church. And it could be, again, like I said before, a church that she was raised in. Her family, you know, people that came to her house to eat. She'd go to their house to eat. But when it came to protecting that Black man, they sacrificed.
It's just an interesting, you know, understanding, because on the one hand, which, you know, I think we all can empathize with and understand about the protection in and of itself, but then the moral responsibility that we have that to defend those that are abused, that I think it's morally irresponsible to protect the church or to protect the synagogue or to protect the institution when there are the vulnerable that are out there that are struggling, and to sweep it under the carpet and say just leave it alone, because the ripple effect of what you or your allegations are going to have has detrimental effect on the church or the synagogue or the religious institution. the part of me that says, so what? Is the institution worth more than the price of humanity?
It has been.
Absolutely.
It has been. But that's why we're here having this conversation. That's why I feel that God called me to this, even though I tried to wrestle my way out of it over and over again. In Jeremiah 23, it talks about lying pastors, prophets, preachers, and how it's not does not sit well with God. And God is going to come back as a whirlwind. And I remember being given that scripture on January 14th in 1994. And I had at the time had really never read it. And my girlfriend that gave it to me didn't even have a Bible, but that's a whole other thing. Mm-hmm. And that she felt that we needed to read that. And it talks about that. And I feel that that is the ministry that I have now, is reminding people of the, you know, we're all bearers of the sacred. Mm-hmm. We're all bearers of the sacred. And one of the things about this is that you see that during the Civil Rights Movement, black men, white and black men and black women walked together. They marched together. But somewhere in the marching, black women and children got left behind. Hmm. You know, somewhere in that, all of that marching and all of that we shall overcome, black women and black children got left behind. And so it's a difficult thing to try to figure out, how can the oppressed, black men know the history of our oppression. How can the oppressed then become the oppressor? Hmm. You know, how if it didn't feel good for you, why do you think it would feel good for someone else?
And do you have you found it all during the implementation of the research you've done and the speaking about this? Have you ever felt pushback or criticism for the work that you do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have. I've been cursed out. I've been invited out of churches. I've been I'm always ignored. And most of my speaking and everything is outside of my denomination. I'm still pressing, trying to get them to allow me to speak within. So a lot of things I do is outside of the AME church.
Gotcha.
Outside of the black church, period.
I mean, I think it goes back to just a blanketing, just training that needs to happen across the board.
And that's all I'm trying to do. Right. I'm trying to improve the church. I'm trying to improve the ability of pastors and preachers to minister. And I'm also trying to improve the ability of laity to worship God in love. That's all I'm trying to do.
You're not accusing.
I'm not accusing. I'm trying to fix the problem.
Right. But from one thing that that as you know, Rabbi and I are two white men over here. The lens we can't understand through our own lens that we see the world is this idea, though, that exactly the history that you just talked about, that you've had this systematic racism that's happened since post-slavery in the States, where, as you were saying, that the African, the black man has been looked at as boy, or using the N-word has been used, and just not looked at as a whole human being. And so now we have our community, the black community, and are we going to start tearing down our own? And that's the pressure that some people feel when you have someone who's been put in this position, as you were saying, of high status, and they might be the smartest person in the congregation, maybe the most well-educated. They went to seminary, and they're an incredible
nice
preacher. They dress well.
Charismatic.
Yes. And so this person who's also might be a great leader in the community, might be doing great things, but then we find out that this pastor also has a wretched bone, you know, this bad bone that's inside of him that's leading to the abuse of others.
But it's also important to recognize that, you know, it's not about education. It's not, abuse knows no lines.
That's true.
No boundaries. And at the end of the day, whether we're educated or we're less educated, we're wealthy, we're poor, it doesn't matter. Is that this sense of abuse and disability happens across all lines.
Yes.
And you know, Reverend Charmaine, I mean, I love the fact that, you know, this is, you know, what was the aim of this of this program is, you know, not in some way to completely and 100% fix the problem, but it's to create a sense of awareness. If this happens, you know, as Jews, use your voices.
Yes.
Use your voice.
Yes.
Speak up. because if you don't speak up, it just it's perpetuating.
You become part of the problem because you also set up the next victim.
Absolutely.
You absolutely do. Yeah. And for women or children and or men in this area that are suffering from any type of abuse, the Inner Truth Project is there to serve you. Please call the Inner Truth Project. It provides services for victims and survivors of any kind of sexual violence.
And you and the rabbi are part of the Inner Truth Project?
Yes, we both sit on the board.
So if someone who is listening right now might know of someone who is either attached or involved or been affected by abuse, they can call the Inner Truth Project.
Yes.
And to receive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Maybe even the station, and they could forward the information to us.
Yep. Okay.
Or you could call the station and get them to call me. I will come.
She will come. 772-220-9788. Is there a website or any way that people can find and find you, or is it really?
You can email me at charmaine@charmainedavis.com. That's charmaine@charmainedavis.com. I'm also Charmaine Davis on Facebook.
So we just keep on praying that there's just more and more awareness of this, that churches continue to do the training that is needed for the awareness of this, and also in seeing the signs and jumping on it just right from the beginning. Because a lot of times you can see those signs, you just have to be like, maybe not. But it's a matter of all this also leadership, seeing just even a smidgen of it and pinpointing and say, hey, what was going on there? Mm-hmm. What was going on there? And we just pray to God that the church and the synagogue and any religious institution is the enemy comes for everyone, especially if you're doing good things.
And I think it goes back to that saying, right? See something, say something.
Yes, definitely.
They definitely
see.
So, Charmaine, we would love to have you on the show again. There's many other topics that we wanted to get to today that we weren't able to. So, God bless you and your ministry.
Thank you very much.
And,
thank you for the opportunity.
Yes. And so we'll have a prayer walk with Charmaine coming up on Palm Sunday. We'll tell you more about that later.
That's
Until then, God bless you and be aware.